Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. For those of you who have not been here before, we're glad to have you and hope you will learn something from this afternoon. This is the afternoon session of the Second Court of Appeals. I'll introduce our panel briefly. To my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my right is Justice Bill Meyer, and I'm Ann Gardner, Justice Ann Gardner. We have two cases on the 1:30 docket to be orally argued and one on the 3 o'clock docket. We have several others that are set for submission but not for oral argument, but that we'll be conferencing on today. The oral arguments are recorded, and I believe you can get them if you want, or you can listen to them on our website, and they should be your should be up by this afternoon or tomorrow. Okay. So if y'all are ready to go ahead and get started, I'll ask Bonnie to call the case, first case. Okay, Mr. Sandberg, ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, yes, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Yes, please do.
May it please the court, good afternoon. While I was preparing for oral argument, I had to make a decision about where I thought I should begin. And from my perspective, this case starts with the fraud cause of action. And if we look at that particular cause of action, and we look at the jury charge, because we're going to measure the sufficiency of the evidence based upon the jury charge, there was no objection to the jury charge, the sole basis for a misrepresentation was a misrepresentation of a past or existing fact. Now, if we look at what the evidence was provided by Ms. Reagan, who was the plaintiff and is now the appellee, there is none. Her sole testimony, as it related to her purchase of the property, was that she was shown the property by Mr. Infeld, who's now deceased, and that was it. Now, she complained about post-closing issues at trial, and we'll get to some of those here in a bit. But when we start with the fraud cause of action, it fails on its face. Additionally, we also discuss in an appellant's brief the fact that there is no reliance. Nowhere in the reporter's record does Ms. Reagan state that she relied upon something that was told to her when she met with Mr. Infeld. Similarly,
you're saying he just showed her a property. He didn't give her a price. They didn't negotiate. They didn't reach an agreement. He just showed her the property, and that was it.
Well, Your Honor, presumably they reached an agreement because it's undisputed Ms. Reagan purchased the property, and there was a dispute about what the price was at the end of the day. But her testimony regarding her communications with Mr. Reagan was that Mr. Infeld showed Ms. Reagan the property. So, yeah. Now, presumably there were, but it's not in the record. So, additionally, in addition to the lack of a past or present fact being misrepresented and the lack of reliance, there's also no damages.
So she didn't rely upon a price being set and later being changed by correction deeds that she didn't know anything about.
Well, Your Honor, that's not how it was presented, because she closed and then there were subsequent documents that she challenged. So that's not a past or present existing fact.
What about concealment?
Well, Your Honor,
or silence?
As it relates to concealment or silence or disclosure, that is not located in the jury charge. And so, Your Honor, as a result, if it's not in the jury charge, it's not evaluated for purposes of the appeal. because there was, again, no objection to the jury charge.
Can't a false representation be made by concealment or by failure to disclose? I mean, there's case law that supports that.
There absolutely can be, Your Honor, and I agree with the court that there is case law that supports it. However, in the absence of that being included in the jury charge, we measure the sufficiency of evidence based upon what's on the jury charge. And so the fact that there is Texas law that supports a failure to disclose as a potential type of misrepresentation, and Appley argues failure to disclose in Appley's brief, but the lack of that in the jury charge means that it's not considered for sufficiency of the evidence purposes.
You're saying that failure to disclose, even though there's case law that supports that that's a misrepresentation, you've got to charge specifically on that under our method of charging in Texas?
Your Honor, that is absolutely correct.
Do you have any case law to support that?
Yes, Your Honor. We cited the court to Cosgrove in our brief, and we also cited it to the Walmart opinion in our brief. We measured the sufficiency of the evidence against what is in the jury charge.
I agree. You measure the sufficiency of the evidence against what's in the jury charge. What I'm asking you, if you have any authority that it's not sufficient to just list the elements of fraud in the jury charge, relying upon case law that failure to disclose or concealment is a misrepresentation. Bad question. I know that. I can tell from the look on your face. I know what I'm saying. You just don't. Do you have any case law that says you have to put that in the charge?
Specifically off the top of my head, Your Honor, I don't remember if the Walmart or the Cosgrove case were specific to a fraud charge. But my argument for purposes of oral argument, and with the court's permission, I can go back and research that. But for purposes of oral argument, I would argue that when it comes to a definition of misrepresentation, we consider for sufficiency of the evidence the definitions that are in the charge. And that would cut across not just fraud, but any other cause of action. We would measure sufficiency of the evidence based upon what is in the charge.
Mr. Sandberg, I'd like to ask you about the evidence. You've been talking about that. You've been at it now for about 5 or 6 minutes. Under the evidence as presented in the case, what do you contend on from in representing your client was the purchase price?
Well,
proven in the record.
Your Honor, there was a disputed issue of fact regarding what the purchase price was.
And I understand that. That's the reason I ask you, what is your contention that was proven in the record as to what was the purchase price?
Well, Ms. Reagan argued that the purchase price was a total of approximately $175,000.
And I've got that. I want to know what you contend your client proved in the record was the purchase price.
Well, in addition to my client, Your Honor, there was additionally another group of defendants, the title company defendants from Mayor Tate.
I understand why they were in there.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I understand why they were in there.
And so I think between both parties' counsel, the proof was that additionally, and there was evidence that additionally, there was another $696,000 note and that second deed of trust that Ms. Reagan disputed executing.
So the purchase price wasn't $175,000, it was $871,000.
Yes, Your Honor, with the math on the top of my head.
Yeah, that's close. Okay. And who proved that excitement? You say the documents from the title company prove that the purchase price was really $800-some thousand and not $175,000.
That is correct, Your Honor.
The documents from the title company reflected a payment of $181,000 as the initial amount of money paid by Ms. Reagan.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. In addition to that, though, and I believe it's undisputed, as far as I remember, that Ms. Reagan initially paid the initial $181,000. Ms. Reagan also testified that after that occurred, According to Ms. Reagan, the $175,000 was returned to her. I'm sorry, the $124,000 and change was returned to her. So that the purchase, according to Ms. Reagan, became $50,000 cash, and Ms. Reagan borrowing an additional $124,000 and change.
But the additional purchase price, as far as she was concerned, was to be handled by a $124,000 deed of trust note.
That is correct, Your Honor. Ms. Reagan admitted the petition, the live pleading, the petition admitted in an oral argument. It was admitted that Ms. Reagan had executed a $124,000 and change note.
And I'm wondering about how the $124,000, there was some issue that she didn't sign the $124,100 note, or she signed a $124,000 note, and even that part of the transaction appears to be muddled in what was actually signed.
Well, and my understanding, based upon what I saw in Appellee's brief, is that Appellee's argument is that Ms. Reagan admits to signing, and I believe we point this out in our reply brief, Ms. Reagan admits to signing a $124,000 and change note and a mortgage on her property. Ms. Reagan's contention and Appellee's brief's contention is that that was a different note than the one that Ms. Reagan, as plaintiff, introduced into evidence at the trial. And so one of the issues that we then discuss in the reply brief is that even just based upon Appellee's argument, the judgment should not have provided declaratory relief voiding the deed of trust as it related to a $124,000 note. And in fact, there was no pleading seeking a cancellation of the $124,000 deed of trust.
Who was the note made to? Who was the payee on that note?
Presumably the sellers, Your Honor, which would be both Mr. And Mrs. Infeld. But I have to admit, off the top of my head, I don't remember what the exhibit introduced by plaintiffs stated.
Right, thank you. So would it be your position that now, as things stand now, at least under the judgment, there is a $124,000 note and some change out there somewhere or owed to your client, and she has title to 1 acre for the $50,000 amount that was left with the title company, and then she has 4 acres that the $124,000 note is consideration for, and the other $124,000 note is voided along with the mortgage, and the $696,000 note is voided.
Well, the judgment the judgment reflects cancellation of both the deeds of trust and the debt in the amount of the $696,000 as well as the $124,000. Mm-hmm. And we discussed in our brief why that was improper. Ms. Reagan's testimony was that she purchased the 5 acres for the $50,000 as well as the additional consideration of the $124,000 note supported by a deed of trust. So,
my reading of your brief, though, is that it's your position that the final judgment voids everything. She gets possession and owes nothing.
Well, and that's the very first issue, Your Honor, is it quacks like a partial rescission or reformation, even though that's not the intent of the parties. But as a partial rescission, we know that's improper. You either entirely rescind or you leave it on its face where it is. And that's the very first issue in our brief. If we look at the relief afforded, that is inappropriate. Additionally, if we look at the final judgment as a declaratory judgment, and this is discussed in issue 3, The jury charge questions do not support the entry of this particular declaratory judgment, because the jury charge question asks if a fraud occurred, and again, as it relates to a past or existing fact, but there is nothing in the jury charge question that specifically relates to the $696,000 deed of trust, the $696,000 note, the smaller note, or the smaller deed of trust. And so this is a case where there is a judgment that is unsupported by the jury charge. So as a result, and we discussed this in our issue number three, the judgment is inappropriate on that basis. Additionally, if we look at the Chapter 12 issue, the jury charge question, which was question four, is predicated upon a finding of fraud in question number one. Question number four doesn't tell the jury what fraud is. And it's specifically linked to, it's predicated upon a affirmative answer of yes to question number one. So as a result, because the fraud cause of action fails, the Chapter 12 issue fails. And so there's no basis for a finding of declaratory relief. I see I'm yellow and about to run out of time here. So thank you very much, Your Honors, for your questions and your time.
All right. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Yale?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And please court.
Counsel.
Justice Gardner, the $124,000 note in deed of trust that were canceled, the deed of trust related to 1/2 acre only. My client testified at trial that she did sign a $124,000 note, just not the one that was introduced. And the deed of trust that related to $124,240 note related to 4 acres of land. Counsel states that my client had limited testimony, but in fact she testified quite readily. I was originally purchasing 5 acres for $175,000. I tendered a check for $181,000 in change to the title company. Later, the deal changed. How did the deal change? I was buying 1 acre for $50,000 and was going to execute a note for $125,000. That same evidence is corroborated by David Walsh, the neighboring landowner, who testified over objection under the dead man statute that Mr. Enfield told him when he introduced Ms. Reagan to him, she just bought the property next door for $174,000. The trial court looked at that and said, that is corroboration. It may not be an exact number, but it approximates what we in fact have here. That was the deal, and that was the only deal.
Did she ever sign a $125,000 or $124,000 note for 4 acres?
She did.
And that was not introduced into evidence?
That's correct. And then, Justice Gabriel, the owner of that note, which was a question, who owned the note, would have been Mr. and Mrs. Enfield. It would have been incumbent upon them to bring that note to the courthouse. It would have been incumbent upon them to bring that deed of trust to the courthouse. Those are not documents that my client had in her possession. Does that answer your question? We're not saying there wasn't a $124,000 note. It just wasn't the one that was presented to the courthouse. If you look at my client's testimony throughout the record, there are several examples of badges of fraud. In fact, when the second closing with the $696,960 note occurred, evidence was presented that she was returning from Carmel, California from her daughter's wedding. Could not have been in the Denton County area. The notary book lacked any notarization signatures for my client or the Enfields during any of these periods of time, although the testimony of Rosemary Kendrick was, my regular course and practice is that when we have a closing, we take a driver's license and we have the participants sign our notary book. It didn't occur. Then we have a correction deed that appears a month or a month and a half later. Every single address for Ms. Reagan in every one of the closing documents was not her address, piece of property she used to own. But this was what was promoted by the seller of the property and the closing defendants. Counsel has made a statement that this case is not ripe for a declaratory judgment action because that's essentially a duplicative action for a suit to quiet title. And there is apparently a split in case law between the Dallas court, the Houston First, and the Houston 14th. The Houston First and the Houston 14th split, but the Max Duncan versus Morningside case out of the Dallas court specifically says Chapter 37004 permits a declaratory judgment action to determine one's rights under a contract or a deed. A deed of trust is a subset of a deed. A note is a subset of a contract. We're declaring both the validity of the $124,000 note and the deed of trust that was presented, as well as the $696,000 note and that deed of trust, as well as, much like the Max Duncan case, when this case was originally filed, it was filed as a temporary restraining order asking for a temporary injunction to prohibit a foreclosure on those two notes and deeds of trust that were not executed by my client.
So is it your position that the final judgment in this case declares that the note that you say your client did sign is fraudulent, or does she still owe that note?
She owes the note she signed, which has never been presented, the $124,240 note, but that is not the note that is in the pleadings.
I understand.
So,
but she still owes it.
She owes it.
Okay.
Any other questions?
She doesn't. The judgment determined that the written documents that were supposedly presented from the title company were all canceled.
Correct.
Well, that cancels this note you just answered that your client still owed, didn't it, Mr. Yale?
No, Justice Meyer. It canceled the note that was presented that was tied to a half-acre parcel of property. There's a note out there somewhere, we believe, that, and I don't want to argue outside the record, but to the extent you're asking me, it's a note that's tied to a deed of trust for 4 acres of land.
Well, Mr. Sandberg said that the $124,000 note that was in the record was introduced by the plaintiff. Now, you represented the plaintiff in the trial. Did you introduce a note that was a wrong note?
We introduced the note that was presented through discovery in the closing of the closing package.
In other words,
from the
when
title
you
company.
Went to the title company and said, give me all the documents, they gave you a copy or an original. Which was it, a copy or the original of a $124,100 note?
It was a copy, sir. There was never, the record is void of any original documents ever being produced, either notes, deeds, or deeds of trust.
We had two real estate agents and an experienced title company and an experienced title closer, and what we ended up with is a complete missing of what was the deal, how much there was a purchase price, and how it was documented.
I would agree, and I would also ask the court to understand that the ownership of those documents is relying upon the title company and or the seller who owns the deed of trust and owns the notes.
And some of those things were recorded, the corrective deed, the deeds, the first deeds, the corrective deeds, the deed of trust, all that's in the county records.
Correct.
So you have copies of what purport to be original documents that were filed in the county records.
Right. And
what was your client's presentation of evidence concerning comparing signatures on those documents?
There were no experts, if that's the court's question. She said.
No, I understand there are no experts. So what I mean is, did your client look at that signature on these documents that were filed of record That was supposed to be her signature and said, that's not my signature.
The answer is yes, but I don't know if that's in the record or a deposition testimony, but that went on for much of the testimony that's contained in volume 3 of the reporter's record.
And the explanation on the other side was testimony from the title company people that she came in, she signed these documents, we filed these documents.
Correct. And then off to the jury to make a decision on who to believe.
And no objections to the jury charge by either side.
Correct.
I think I've got the picture.
Was the original $124,000 deed of trust that you say your client still owes, was that filed of record? Is that in the Denton County records?
There is but one deed of trust for $124,240, and that relates to a half acre. And I believe that is, I was looking for the exhibit number.
It says on reporter's record volume 3, page 6769, L23-4 in your brief.
All right. That that would be testimony with regard to that. There was likely a, most of the exhibits are in volume 10 and 11.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
So.
Sorry, Judge. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Any further questions?
I believe not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll have rebuttal now from Mr. Sandberg.
May I please the court? Something came to me when I was sitting down in response to, I believe, your first question, Justice Gabriel. You asked about the subsequent dispute over what the purchase price was. If anything, and of course we don't, putting aside the fact the parties disagree as to what the purchase price was and what the correct documents are, if anything though, the post-closing dispute regarding what the appropriate purchase price is would be at the time that Ms. Reagan agreed to purchase the property, not an existing fact. It would be potentially a promise to do something in the future at an agreed upon price if it was done with the appropriate intent. But again, promise to do something in the future lacking the intent at the time the promise was made, which is another, admittedly, another type of fraud under Texas law, is not in the jury charge. Counsel spoke about the Max Duncan opinion. And according to counsel, that opinion stands for the legal principle that declaratory judgment actions are appropriate to determine the validity of notes and the validity of deeds and thus deeds of trust. Actually, if we look at that particular case, it does support declaratory judgment relief as being appropriate for validity of a note. It does not support declaratory judgment relief for the validity of a deed of trust. That falls under, again, it's a, as we discuss in both of our briefs, the a suit to quiet title, for which attorney's fees are not available. And during my prior presentation, I have not yet discussed with the court the fact that we need to consider and separate when declaratory judgment relief is available versus when attorney's fees under Chapter 37 is available, because there is an analytical difference. And just because relief under Chapter 37 is available, that doesn't necessarily mean attorney's fees are available. In this particular case, this is a situation where plaintiff brought a breach of contract action. They brought a fraud action. And so those causes of action, according to plaintiff's pleadings at the time, had already accrued. As a result, the declaratory judgment action is just another means of trying to get attorney's fees. And it's inappropriate for the trial court to have awarded attorney's fees. When we discussed,
get attorney's fees for Chapter 12 and for fraud.
Well, you can, Your Honor, but we also discussed the fact that the declaratory judgment to the extent it might be supported by a Chapter 12 cause of action. The evidence is insufficient. And in this particular case, we have a declaratory judgment. We don't have a appropriate Chapter 12 jury charge question that got answered affirmatively because it relates back to the fraud cause of action for which there's insufficient evidence. So there is no appropriate Chapter 12 basis for attorney's fees. Similarly, while attorney's fees might be available for a statutory fraud under Chapter 27, and absolutely, Your Honor, that's available there, we don't have a final judgment awarding attorney's fees for a statutory fraud. This particular judgment awards attorney's fees under Chapter 37. So, and then additionally, again, we don't have any damages that would support a statutory fraud. We don't have any reliance upon anything that would support a statutory fraud. We don't have any misrepresentations of existing or past fact as stated in the jury charge that would support a statutory fraud. So, I didn't talk about that before, but I did want to also remind the court that that's
Mr. Sandberg, I have not completely finished reading this record, but I'm going to read it some more because my curiosity's piqued on how did this transaction get in this shape. Now, there was no attorney representing the seller. There was no attorney representing the buyer. We had only Mr. Tate, who's an attorney. He was working at the title company. Did he draw all the documents as part of his work at the title company?
My understanding is that the documents were drawn up by Mayor Tate, but I have to admit, I was not brought in as an attorney. I see I'm out of time. May I continue, please?
Yes, you need to answer my last question. You can go ahead and answer my question. I'm not presiding, Your Honor.
Go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you. I should ask permission before I, because I'm out of time. My involvement in this case occurred post-judgment. So I admittedly wasn't representing one at the time. My understanding is that it was Mayor Tate's office that drew up the documents. But I also have to represent to the court. I could very easily be wrong about that.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you both very much for your arguments and your briefs. Your case is submitted.